From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, this is Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, and today for Michael Krasny. In this hour of Forum, we continue our first-person interview series with scientist and green energy entrepreneur Saul Griffith. His many inventions include a device to create low-cost eyeglass lenses for people in third-world countries, which helped him win a MacArthur Genius Grant. Griffith has co-founded several R&D projects, including one called Makani Power, that attracted millions of dollars from Google to pursue energy generation with high-altitude kites. Saul Griffith joins us for the hour, and we'll get started with Forum right after this. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. And this hour, we continue our first-person interview series, conversations with leaders, innovators, and others who make the Bay Area so unique. And my guest this hour is someone who may not be a household name, but whose inventions and high-end tinkering at the frontiers of science are aimed at engineering a better quality of life for all of us. Saul Griffith is a native of Australia who came to California a decade ago after earning a PhD from MIT with a focus on machines that can replicate themselves. He's co-founded a number of research endeavors here in the Bay Area, working on products ranging from inflatable robots to cheap prescription eyeglasses to generating wind energy using high-altitude kites. He employs a fleet of software developers, engineers, and inventors in his various companies, and his work earned him a MacArthur Genius Award in 2007. Saul Griffith, welcome to Forum.
Thank you very much.
Well, we want to talk about the future, but first I want to talk about the past a little bit. You grew up in Sydney, I think, or in Australia anyway. Your dad was an engineer, and your mom was a wildlife artist. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So what was your childhood like?
Idyllic, I think. Now I have a son who's 4, and I'm about to have a daughter in a couple of weeks. So I think a lot about childhood at the moment. And you know, Australia had a fantastic public education system. So I remember that the lack of concern about what would be schooling was fabulous. Hmm. But you know, apart from that, my life was great. We joked that our house was one third my mother's workshop, one third my father's workshop, and we squeezed a kitchen and a couple of bedrooms between.
And were you kind of how would you describe yourself as a kid? Were you kind of like nerdy? That's a stereotype about people who are into engineering and those kinds of things.
I guess I was a nerdy child, although I also played a lot of nerdy sports, so maybe that was fitting.
What's a nerdy sport?
It's something that most people don't know about me, and when they find out, they find it hard to believe. I played an awful lot of golf as a child.
Oh yeah,
we lived right next to a golf course, so it was you know, a free babysitter for me. So I had a misspent youth playing golf, and then when I wasn't playing golf, engineering and building various things, lots of hobbies. I went through all of the hobbies: remote control cars, fireworks, and explosives. You know, the normal spectrum.
Yeah. What was the first thing that you sort of invented that you remember as a kid?
The first thing I really remember obsessing over for a whole summer, I couldn't have been much older than 8, and I really wanted to have the grappling hook that Batman had.
And to climb up the side of buildings?
Climb up the side of buildings. So I remember experimenting, you know, it wasn't highfalutin science or engineering, just with different kinds of wire and ways to make a hook and different pieces of string or twine that would support my weight. So I wanted it to be as invisible as possible so I could, no one would see me. And so, you know, I fell down the side of our house a number of times as the fishing line didn't have high enough test strength or the metal on the hooks bent back. And I have a lot of visceral happy memories about failing repeatedly.
You didn't have a utility belt, did you, like Batman?
I just wanted the grappling hook. I'm sure I hit it in some sort of utility belt, but the thing I distinctly remember sort of working on was this grappling hook.
Yeah. So you say Australia had a great education system, but you came to the States for graduate work at MIT and then a PhD. What brought you over here?
I think, you know, Australia has a great education system up through high school. America really, especially its graduate schools, are still the best in the world. I know there's a lot of hand-wringing about it, but your top-tier universities here are truly astonishing, to the point I didn't even know when I was arriving what I was getting myself into. I went to MIT quite unaware of what it was even all about, and then was just pleasantly surprised. It's really, apart from the horrible cold weather of Boston, it's really quite a magical place.
So you were there about, what, 6 years, 7 years?
6 years. I was enjoying it so much, I took extra time.
And then you came out here with some of your buddies after you got your PhD. And to talk about your graduate work and the emphasis on, was it replicatable robots?
So, yeah, I worked the very early times at MIT. I was working on what became electronic ink, that's now the Kindle. And then that work migrated into trying to work on printed electronics. And you know, all of the work that I was doing and our research group was doing under Joe Jacobson and Neil Gershenfeld was really new ways to make machines and new capabilities. And I got sort of, when you look at all the machines that humanity makes, they all pale in comparison to even the simplest biological organism. So it was like, how can we build things the way that biology does? And if you, what's magic about biology is you throw information into a bucket and out comes a squirrel. You know, you throw a different piece of information into the bucket and out comes a snake or a fish or a butterfly. And so I was very concerned with doing that, and we worked on the theory of it, and you know, not being a biologist, rather than attack it through biology, it was like, can we actually artificially build a machine that has these behaviors, and figured out how to do that? And you sort of for free get self-replication as one of the behaviors of these little robot-y things you build. Unfortunately, it becomes the headline, but I think the much cooler work was we figured out how to make a just like proteins fold, sort of solved something analogous to the protein folding problem, that we can make a string of very simple blocks make any three-dimensional shape you'd like.
Yeah. And speaking of unusual organisms, you came out here in 2004 or so, and shortly thereafter you co-founded Squid Labs.
So is the unusual organism the squid or are the people that I came out here
well,
with?
Well, you tell me. Why squid, first of all?
So Squid Labs, we named it after squid because squid have great eyesight, nominally quite big brains, and they solve puzzles. They actually are used in experiments to solve puzzles. And to be honest, perfectly honest, it was four of us, Colin, Eric, Dan, and myself, and we really didn't know what we were doing. We just knew that we wanted to start a business. And, you know, to give you an idea of how naive we were, while still in Boston, we looked at a map of America and thought, where should we start this business? And we were trying to co-locate somewhere that had really good wind, because we were all interested in windsurfing and kitesurfing, and somewhere where there was a technology community. And San Francisco, because of its great wind, really won out. And to a smaller extent, you know, proximity to Silicon Valley.
Yeah, well, you picked well. You chose well. And so tell me what you're working on now. Let's go into the future, or the present, I guess. You created something called Makani Power Company. And what you're really, I think, what most people are talking about most recently is the work you're doing with kites and generating wind energy from high-altitude kites. Am I describing that right?
So you are describing Makani Power correctly. Actually, that company was just acquired by Google. So we developed the capacity to generate, you know, fly very large kites. They don't resemble much kites. They look more like very advanced aircraft. And they fly quite high in the sky and generate electricity. What looks like it's going to be more cheaper than traditional wind turbines. Right. So I moved on from then that company in about 2008 to start Other Lab, which is where I am now. And we're now located just a couple of blocks here from KQED's offices.
In an old pipe organ factory.
An old pipe organ factory, which is wonderful. And we have a number of projects. And like Makani Power, it was really, you know, how do we solve climate change, making better, more efficient, lower cost energy technologies? And that's one of the things we do at Other Lab. And one of our big projects right now is a solar project. Seeking to make the heliostats that track the sun a whole lot cheaper to enable cheaper solar energy. We're also working on natural gas technologies for making cars and light trucks drive on natural gas, a domestic fuel that's lower carbon. We have a wonderful program in soft robots, which intellectually is one of the coolest things we're doing, just because we're, for the first time in history, really designing machines that have no rigid parts. They're just, you know, bags of air and jelly.
These are like the inflatable robots that I've seen on the website.
Exactly. And so that's super fun. And then we have two other sort of projects going on. We write a lot of design tools, so software that enables all of these types of new things to be designed and engineered. And then we're just this week spinning out a company called Other Machine Company that's making computer-controlled machine tools for for everyone, hobbyists and small companies and the like. So this is like, you know, like 3D printers, but more.
Yeah. So you mentioned climate change earlier. Is that what you see as the biggest sort of issue that needs to be addressed from a scientific perspective?
Absolutely. Unequivocally, we need to figure that out this century, and specifically how...
Really in the century, I think.
Really in the century. And really, you know, we're running out of time. You know, our chances of stopping even at modest targets like 450 parts per million are pretty much past. So we need to get on this. So I see that as a very important problem to work on. But, you know, as I get older, I also think that the sort of the inequality that we have worries me socially, which ranges from economic to educational inequalities. So I think we need, you know, we are not running out of tough, hard problems for humanity to work on, which
might be
job security for people like me.
Talking with Saul Griffith, he's an inventor whose designs are very futuristic. He is working on, among other things, inflatable robots with walking animal balloons. He's based here in San Francisco. He's also a former winner of the MacArthur Genius Grants. What difference did that make to you, by the way, winning that $500,000?
Gives me the opportunity to give back to NPR and KQED.
Are you a donor?
No, and then actually, so when you call me up and say, do you want to be on the show? I'm like, I have this nagging guilt that we haven't paid our fees this year. So I say yes.
We've nagged everybody. Yeah, we'll go.
Everyone out there, subscribe so you don't have to come on the show.
Yeah, good. Hey, I've got a note from my producer here, Irene, says, flesh out a little bit more of the soft robot thing. They're very cool, and you can see the sort of the videos on them on the website. But describe, you know, how you came up with the idea and what the significance of them is.
So it's just purely for the fun of it is sort of the reason why we ended up working on this. And now I think the significance is super interesting. So the origins was I used to make – all of the kites we used to make were inflatable, so they had a pressurized air vessel in them. And one Christmas, I made my niece, just for kicks, because we were testing some software, an inflatable elephant. It was about 5 foot high, and she would jump around with it on the trampoline and et cetera. And after Christmas, she said, you know, Uncle Saul, can you please make my elephant walk? And really, it was that, you know, innocent question from a beautiful six-year-old girl that said, oh, well, actually, we probably could. So we figured out how to make some novel inflatable actuators. They're like muscles or motors. Sewed them onto this elephant. I actually had my sister post that elephant back from Australia to here. So my poor niece now doesn't have her elephant. But that elephant now walks. And from that, we've sort of thought, wow, this is huge. And, you know, and I phrase the insight and the innovation here in the following way. If you think about every machine that humanity has ever built, they're all made out of stiff and rigid and hard elements, sort of metals and ceramics and wood. And if you think about biology, everything that biology makes is sort of fleshy and soft and robust. And it's really exciting to be able to think about creating for every hard, rigid object that is out there, creating soft machines to replace them. And these robots are, I think, the tip of a very large iceberg and what I think is a really exciting area for engineering in general.
And aside from exciting nieces and nephews, what's the utility? Or is that a silly question?
I think the utility is everywhere. We're immediately interested in orthotics and prosthetics. So this is replacement limbs for prosthetics or orthotics, which are machines that augment your strength. So for an aging population, you know, machines that are like wearable pants but can help you with your broken hip or regain motor control after a stroke. So I think they're really beautiful applications. Then the field of human-safe robotics. So we hear a lot of headlines about robots, but traditionally, once you build a robot, you lock it in what's called a cell to keep the humans out so that the robot can't injure, an errant human. Human-safe robotics is making robots safe enough to work with and alongside. And you kind of, you know, softness is a feature you would like if you want to be working alongside this robot. We don't give up any strength. We try to make it so, you know, if it swings around and doesn't see you, it doesn't knock you out.
Yeah. So how do you approach problems when you're in the lab? I mean, there's all, of course, thinking outside the box is sort of an overused phrase, but I'm sure you do plenty of that. But how do you apply your way of looking at the world to problems?
I think number one, most importantly, is you surround yourself with a whole bunch of smart people who don't believe your hype and you don't believe theirs, so you all keep each other honest. I think that's hugely important. And so I have a wonderful set of people at Other Lab that we think about these things with. And then, you know, I think everyone comes up with these sort of grandiose statements like the one I just made, like every machine should be soft. And then you just sort of apply that grandiose idea across all the different areas that you could apply it and see, oh, you know, well, that would be useful over here and it would be useful on this problem that I'm aware of from the past. And then you dive deep and see if you really have an interesting solution to some challenge there.
And how long do you think is reasonable to sort of work on a theory before you say, well, you know, this isn't really working?
While ever it remains true, you keep working on it. And so, you know, we have a grand theory of energy systems and energy technologies, which is, you know, to make renewable energy cheap, you need to cover large surface areas cheaply. So you need to design very efficient machines. That was the insight behind Makani Power. That's the insight behind our heliostats. And that seems to be remaining true and is true. And then we have this sort of similar grand idea about soft robots. And then, you know, one of the other things that is one of our grand ideas at the moment is there's a real innovation in the how control costs less than it ever has before.
What do you mean by that?
Just the capacity to control a machine with software and to run its servos, etc. You know, in this particular area where we work, CNC machines or robotic manufacturing machines used to cost $10,000 or so for each, what they call a degree of freedom. So each sort of thing that each control point that you have on that machine, that cost has gone to about $10 in the past few years, which now means that we can enable all sorts of fabulous little bespoke CNC machines. And so that's one of the other, that low cost of control is, it enables those CNC machines. It's also what's enabling the soft robotics we're doing. So you have these sort of grand themes, and then you apply them to very specific problems. And if you don't apply them to specific problems, you're sort of, working off in the ether.
Yeah. Yeah. What is there a big grand theme or a big, grand idea you had that turned out to be just flat wrong?
Most of them. we really...
What's the success rate? I mean, like, how many, goofy ideas do you have for ones that are really out of the ballpark?
I think the success rate, most ideas work in some fashion, but do they work commercially is potentially...
That's really the goal.
It is lovely to just create things just
for
because
your niece.
They're beautiful. And, who doesn't want an inflatable elephant to ride to school? but you have to, to stay alive in this world, you have to make them worthwhile. Our success rate is, better than 30% on making it as a commercial technology, better than 80% on just making it work. So you got to choose your problems carefully .
And those people that you surround yourself with, those smart people that, question everything and think differently, how do you interview them? How do you hire people? What kind of questions do you ask them?
We are super lucky. People come to us. So we very rarely have to actively advertise for jobs. People want to work on – there's a real latent need in young, smart people to work on hard and interesting problems, and the energy and environmental problems are hard and interesting, and these new kinds of robotics are hard and interesting. So we interview them, we ask them all sorts of difficult questions about mathematics and physics and, are they passable in all these systems? The interview question that I like asking the most is just to ask people to draw a bicycle. And this sounds a sort of trivial question, but you would be surprised how many people can't anatomically draw a bicycle correctly on a sheet of paper, which is a bad sign if you're hiring someone for sort of an engineering job.
What do they do wrong?
Oh, the cranks will be in the wrong place, or the it'll be an impossible machine that you wouldn't be able to steer if it actually existed, or you would be shocked because it sounds like such a simple step.
Yeah. And what's the craziest sort of bicycle design you've gotten out of that question?
Oh, well, so the people who are so on top of their bicycle game, they will take this as a challenge to build you amazing, beautiful, flying helicopter bicycles that, conceivably would work. So we get the winners of this interview question have some spectacular bicycle planned.
Ever build any of them?
Well, I have a bicycle habit, as my wife will attest. So I'm constantly building bicycles. In fact, one of my fun projects at the moment is trying to make robots that make bicycles.
Yeah. Are you, would you say, a bike activist? I mean, there's a lot of, you know, the Bicycle Coalition here in San Francisco is very, very powerful. Are you part of that?
I was arrested as a bicycle activist the day before the Kyoto Agreement was signed. For blockading the Sydney Harbour Bridge. So when I was an angry young man, I was 20 or something. So I was very much a cycle activist in the active sense.
But not so much here.
Now I'm a cycle proponent in a more passive way. I think it's a beautiful and sustainable form of transportation.
Yeah. My guest this hour is Saul Griffith. He's an inventor who founded a number of labs and invention operations, including Squid Labs, Makani Power, and your most recent one is Other Lab. That's your new venture right
Other
here
lab.
In, the,
That's
in
right.
the Other Lab here in the San Francisco, the Mission District, and also very involved in the DIY movement. I want to talk with you about that as well. And if you'd like to talk with Saul Griffith, maybe suggest a new sort of bicycle or a way of generating power, give us a call. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. 866-733-6786. And as always, you can email your questions and comments to forum@kqed.org or leave a comment on our Facebook page as well. You have written articles. You do write articles for Make magazine. And the movement, the DIY movement, is everything from, you know, making soaps and jam to much more complicated things. So what's your take on that whole phenomenon of the DIY movement?
You know, I think it's fantastic. So I think Make magazine is the poster child of this movement. But, you know, Popular Mechanics, Popular Science, there's a lot of other places this is expressing itself. I think it's great because a lot of kids are having their passions ignited for building things. And I think at the end of the day, what I love most is we're encouraging a generation that the world is theirs to create. You know, if you don't like the shape or color of the world as it is, you actually have the capacity to go and change it and build it and modify it. So that's, I think, the best of the aspirational aspects of the DIY movement. My concern is we've been to this rodeo before. There was the arts and crafts movement just as a sort of a reaction against the Industrial Revolution, which was sort of a maker movement of kinds. And then there was the Boy Scouts movement just after World War II that was also sort of a DIY movement. And they were great things also. But, you know, what is the outcome we're trying to affect here? But I'm very hopeful because I think it sends a positive message to people that we can create and engineer the type of world we want to live in.
And do you think, is there an element of sort of anti-consumerism to it? You know, where we buy too much stuff?
I think there's a small element of that. To be honest, I think a lot of it is most people's jobs an awful lot of people's jobs are fairly static jobs sitting at a keyboard now. And I think people's hands just want to make things. And so a lot of people are using their spare hours now to make things where it used to be, you know, it's now the avocation as opposed to the vocation.
Saul Griffith is going to be with us for the rest of this hour. We'd love to hear from you about anything you've heard this first half hour or anything else you'd like to talk with him about. I'm sure we have a wide range of things you'd love to talk to him about, and we'd love to hear from you. 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or email us. It's forum@kqed.org. I'm Scott Schaefer here today for Michael Krasny. Stay with us. And welcome back to Forum. Scott Schaefer here this morning for Michael Krasny. And my guest this hour is Saul Griffith, MacArthur Genius Award winner in 2007. He is from Australia, came to this country to study at MIT, and then came out here to the West Coast and has been inventing things ever since. And if you'd like to join us to talk with him about robots, wind energy, solar energy, manufacturing, education, whatever it might be, give us a call, 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786. Just during the break, you know, we were talking about one of your sort of high-profile inventions that wasn't a huge success, and this was the idea of creating low-cost prescription eyeglass lenses. What happened to that idea?
So it's interesting, you know, as an inventor, you sort of create technology options, and then the market tells you whether you win or lose. So we were trying to create a machine that we could go anywhere in the world and make you your eyeglasses on demand in a few minutes right there. Traditionally, you have to have a huge library of lenses, and so it's impractical to sort of go into Central America with a truckload full of lenses and provide people things. So we wanted to make a machine that could make them all. But ultimately, I think the technology worked, but we were beaten by the sheer brute force, low-cost manufacturing of China. And, you know, you can now FedEx a pair of eyeglasses for a dollar anywhere in the world you know, within a week or so.
Really? And is that happening? I mean, are people who need in impoverished places, are they getting eyeglasses?
I mean, well, it's a little bit. We used to sort of hope that we would be able to make it possible for eyeglasses to cost less than $10 anywhere in the world. You know, a small multiple of the average daily wage would have been a great outcome. You know, I can now in San Francisco go online to a number of websites and order an $8 pair of prescription glasses for myself that work perfectly well.
You want to share those websites? I'm sure a lot of people would like to know about those.
You know, the things like Zenni Optical. You know, there's a whole lot of them. Glasses.com or something.
Not the frames. Are you talking about the
full the frames, the lenses, the whole thing delivered to your door? You know, $7.95, and if you get super fancy, you can pay $12 or $13.
So you just have to have the prescription.
You just have to have the prescription, and I think so. That's fabulous, and that's, you know, they get there by making thousands of lenses at low cost, and then. So I think the solution to the problem that we identified a decade ago is now, you know, leverage that high-volume manufacturing and then use cheap shipping. So, you know, I learned a lot about sort of entrepreneurship and business models from that experience.
Yeah, and speaking of the, you know, the Chinese, I mean, they're also in a big way in solar and other kinds of renewable energies, right? Which is a good thing, right? Shouldn't we be happy about that?
Yeah, I think we should. The argument at the moment is they are perverting the price of solar a little bit with various government subsidies. I'm unsure whether I think it's a good or a bad thing. I don't know enough about the macroeconomics of it. But in general, we want to make as many renewable resources as fast as possible.
Especially in China. I mean, you want them to be using them. All right, let's go to the phones and let's begin in Woodside. And Brad, I think, is on the line. Good morning.
Yeah. Hi. I have a question which regards where does sort of software engineering fit into this new hardware revolution in Silicon Valley? I mean, you hear about all these new hardware startups, now hardware is the new thing, but where does software engineering and creative software fit into all of this?
That's all.
I think hardware and software are really merging. We have an incredible team of software engineers at Other Lab, and nearly every hardware project that we begin starts with an awful lot of software, simulation software, design tools that we write specific to those problems, optimization software. And that, in some respects, these new software tools enable new kinds of hardware to exist. And that's something we sort of specialize in. So I think it's a great time to be a software engineer who is aware of hardware because the interaction between the two is great. And as one of the Mike Estee in our office is fond of saying, you know, hardware is the ultimate security key. So, you know, if you're selling hardware, no one can really copy it the way they copy software. So,
does that respond to your question?
Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go now to San Francisco, and Lee is on the line. Welcome.
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, it just went right when my name was announced. So, at any rate, this is a fascinating program, and your experiences, Mr. Griffith, with the commercial side of your inventions probably will be very good for my question, which is, what is your process for investigating patents that are existent or have just lapsed, and that process with your innovations?
So this is a really interesting question. And patents, obviously, we file a lot of patents at Other Lab. In some respects, intellectual property or patents are our main product. My patent attorney comes in once a year to scream and shout at everyone in the office, whatever you do, do not read the patent literature. So there's a curious artifact of the way patents are. If you knowingly violate somebody's patent, you have to pay triple their damages.
Hmm.
If you unknowingly violate somebody else's patent, you only have to pay single damages.
So they want you to, he wants you to remain, or she, remain ignorant.
Yeah, so you are biased by the nature of the system to remain ignorant. That's not entirely possible, obviously, but you know, we largely try to adhere to that. But at the same time, you don't want to be reinventing the wheel. So you do need to know what the state of the art in the area that you're working in is. And then you need to have a rigorous process to file patents. I think the larger question is super interesting. Is the patent office and the patent system up to scratch for today's world? And I think the answer to that is no. It takes too long. Innovation is on a faster time cycle than you can get the patents through. The patent system really works for large companies who want to fight it out in courtrooms with each other. It does not in any way help the small inventor or the small company. It really looks like a very expensive cost of doing business to small and sole operators.
All right. Thanks very much for the call. Let's go to Sunnyvale now, and Ina is on the line. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about the rise again of the celebrity inventor, something I think of as associated with the 1800s, and I'm seeing it again now. And I noticed that it's had an impact on my son's school. He's 7, and they spent a lot of time talking about how you could be the next great inventor. Is that something that we should be promoting? And if so, how?
Wow, if that's true, that's fabulous.
You didn't know you were a celebrity.
I did not know that I was a celebrity.
Did you see the paparazzi out when you walked in?
Yeah, I'll wear dark sunglasses and a hat when I leave. But I think it is fabulous for young children to idolize women and men who use their brains for a living, not just sports people and actors and actresses. All of the above is good, but I think that we certainly underappreciate the engineers and the scientists of the world. I might say to you, I've had the following thought a lot. In the age of discovery, we really, the adventures were going to new continents and discovering them and finding new species in lost rainforests. We've done so much of that I think all of the, these journeys of adventure now are in some respects journeys of invention. And certainly the colleagues that I work with and the fellow inventors that I know, they really have the same sort of spirit of adventure as I think Shackleton and these types of characters are. And I think it's such a wonderful activity and career to be engaged in if you can make it financially work, because you know every day it's really a journey and an adventure.
And Ina, can I just ask you, who does he think of as a celebrity inventor?
Well, the current person, I guess, is Mark Zuckerberg, probably, because of the ideas. But it goes from person to person. All the kids at the school are like that.
Yeah.
Whoever's got the next big thing is kind of like who they're really interested in.
Yeah. All right.
They all read Make magazine. It's really kind of funny. So I was curious about how we could promote that.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Thanks very much for the call. And Saul, I mean, it seems like, as you said, there's a dire need for especially American kids to graduate with more knowledge of engineering and science and mathematics. If you listen to the high-tech companies in Silicon Valley, they're saying that's why they need to go overseas, right? They can't find qualified workers here.
I've heard the quote that the unemployment rate across America for engineers is less than 2%. In the Bay Area, it's less than 1%. We're not graduating enough engineers, enough technical people. The future is going to be more technical, not less technical. That's almost certain.
Silicon Valley? Your world. I'd be curious to know how many women, for example, what percentage of your employees are women?
We're doing fabulously well. This is the best office I've ever had in terms of women. So we are about a quarter or more women in technical positions. Which may not sound, like 50%, but, compared to my engineering classes at MIT, which were 5 or 10%, it's great. In fact, two of our main projects are being run and led and spun out of as startup companies by fabulous technical women CEOs, Leila Madrone and Danielle Applestone, and they're doing tremendous jobs. And they're great role models.
Yeah, there aren't many, if you think about it, women role models for girls in the tech world. I mean, there's a couple, you know, but not many.
There's a few. There's
especially
not enough
in the inventor world. I mean, there's a few CEOs, obviously.
Yeah, you know, there are women have invented all manner of fabulous things. Marie Curie is obviously a very famous one. Lady Ada Lovelace and her contributions to computing. Lamore Fried is a friend of mine who runs a wonderful thing called Adafruit Industries out of New York City. She's a fabulous inventor, entrepreneur. You know, I think there's more. We don't celebrate them enough, and I think this general theme that we're now on in this conversation, you know, how do we celebrate inventors more and engineers and scientists is really something very close to my heart.
Yeah. What about the education system? We started this conversation, and you're saying how terrific the school system was in Australia. You've got a young son who's about to enter school. How are you thinking about his education?
Scott, I thought I made you promise not to ask me about San Francisco schooling. It's going to be tough.
It was a general question.
I think it's a tremendously interesting time to think about education. If you think about the education system that we've ended up with everywhere in the world, which is one teacher teaching roughly 30 kids in an industrial process, that is really only an artifact of the last industrial revolution. We needed to train more people for those various enterprises, and this was the model we came up with. The future does not look like 1910 anymore. So I think it's a great time to question what is school, period, and why are we still so slavishly working on this old model? And there's all of this online learning that's rising up. So I think it's a great time to ask those questions. You know, having said that, there's a lot of inertia in the existing school system, so my kid will have to go into the existing school system, and I'm finding that decision-making process very difficult, to be honest.
Yeah, and what do you – you must have other friends who are parents of young kids. How are they, you know, puzzling that through?
We nearly always throw up our hands and say, let's just start a school.
Why don't you?
Well, you know, time and everything else.
If you started a school, what would it be like?
You know, I think the Montessori, you know, all of these, the Montessori, the Waldorf, all of these systems had kind of, they were all very hands-on based. And I think that's super interesting. I have a friend, Xander Rose, he actually runs the Long Now Foundation in the Bay Area. He and I, when we discussed this, he had a great idea. He thinks that the university of the future looks like one great mentor using all of the world's online courses to mentor and guide roughly 20 young people who essentially have a big workshop. So it's hands-on all the time with this workshop to go and test and implement the things that you see and read and learn in these online lectures. And I think there's, you know, a whole lot of interesting potential new models like that. So I think my school that I would, you know, the school I would have liked to have gone to would have had a lot more project time. And we would have been able to much more easily draw connections between the projects and the sort of the theories, the things that you need to learn.
There was an interesting article in the New York Times maybe a year ago, and it was looking at parents, high-tech parents who work in Silicon Valley, and the fact that they really limit their kids' access to video games and computers because they felt that, you know, too much of that was really not enhancing learning or socializing or whatever it might be. What are your thoughts about that?
Oh, my immediate thoughts is I'm failing. My son woke up early this morning and demanded the iPad, and I gave in pretty quick. I don't know. I played a lot of video games when I was a kid, and I learned a lot of problem-solving skills, a lot of hand-eye coordination from them. I'm starting to think they're not as bad. And, you know, the variety and quality of games that we now have on these devices like the iPads and the various Galaxy devices are astounding, and many of them have a lot of good educational things. So I don't think your child should do these things for 8 hours a day, and they certainly need to get out and do some physical activity. But I don't know. I kind of think this game-mediated learning is interesting, and there is a lot. Let's not throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones, and Miriam is on the line from Elsa Bronte. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. Yeah, I had a question about making practical some kinds of technologies that are already out there but don't seem to be quite moving over the hump to renewable energy. And I had four of them in mind. The first obvious one is these solar roofs. And I've asked other people, well, instead of building new power plants or new power technologies, why isn't the money just invested in giving everybody in California a solar roof, and then that power could be fed back into the grid? And people keep telling me things like, well, it's not practical because there isn't the battery capacity, and what if it rains, and yada-da, yada-da. I'm not convinced that they're telling me the truth, so I wanted to know what your guest had to say on that. Then there's three others briefly.
How about one? Just give me one, power. Because we're a little short.
There's a school up at a building up at Oberlin College where they've powered the entire building with the excrement of two cows. And that seems like, you know, we're paying for these huge sewer systems, and we don't have electricity that's sustainable. So it seems like, you know, there's something being missed there.
Yeah.
And then there's two others. One is...
Let's all jump in here for a second.
You know, I think all of these technologies, I can probably guess the next two you're going to mention because they're going to be in the energy space. There's been a huge amount of progress in these various renewable technologies, and I would love their... to be more of them being deployed, as you suggest. The reality today is they're just not cost competitive with fossil fuels. And, you know, the Department of Energy is running a fantastic program right now called Sunshot, which is explicitly trying to get the cost of these sort of rooftop solar systems and all types of solar systems at cost parity. That means that, you know, they cost the same or less than coal-fired generated electricity. Solar is not quite there yet. Wind is not quite there yet. Biogas conversion, like your cow's methane to power the school, is not quite there yet, which, to be honest, is why we need as many engineers and scientists and, you know, the best... I really hope that the best minds of our generation and generations to come work on these problems, because we must solve these to meet the demands of climate change.
What do you think is the real ultimate potential for renewables in terms of the percentage of power that it can supply?
We have to hope it's 100%. if you want to stop increasing the carbon dioxide concentration, you want to get to 100%, or you want to have a much more rational public debate about using nuclear power, which I think is a good option that we don't explore well enough because we don't have a very good public debate about it.
Yeah. Miriam, thanks for the call. I'm sorry we didn't get to your other two invention ideas. So you would be more supportive of nuclear?
Tepidly supportive. It certainly needs discussing.
The best of bad alternatives?
It's you know, statistically per unit of power generated, it kills less people than coal. So
I think France is entirely...
nuclear, very, very high portion of France's electricity grid is nuclear. It can be done well. It can be done safely. There's some risk to all technologies. We really need to have a public discussion that looks more that, you know, not even solar is perfect. To do all of the world with solar power, there are so many solar cells that you start to maybe think that they are a blight. So we're going to want to mix, and we should be. It's really an aesthetic question what that mix looks like, and it's a question about risk.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the phones. And Drew in Los Altos, you're on with Saul Griffith.
Hello, Mr. Griffith. I'm just actually going into college next year, and I wanted to understand what would be the best way for me to prepare myself, because in the future I want to use engineering software principles to kind of apply those principles to problems that we see in our in various systems, and I just wanted to understand what could I do right now to kind of self-educate myself for that.
So I'm guessing you're 18 or 19 years old.
Yes.
Here's a secret to the universe that I wish someone had told me. When you're 18 or 19 and you're fresh-faced and you're bright, the world will let you invite you in to look at everything they do. By the time you're 30, they think you're a competitor who's going to steal their ideas and walk away with their business. So I did a lot of this when I was young, and I wish I had have done more. I went and saw every manufacturing plant that I could in Sydney, and I would call up the owners of these companies, whether they were making bread or toothpaste or solar cells. Didn't matter what it was. I was just interested in how they were made. And I would call them up and say, hey, I'm a bright young thing. I'm going to do engineering in college. Can I come and see your factory? And they will always say yes. People love highly motivated young people. And, you know, it's a compliment to them, if you think about it, that you're saying, I think what you do is cool. I like the way you make toothpaste. Let me come and have a look. So while you have this brief window in time when you're non-threatening, go and steal everyone's ideas and have a look at how they do everything.
Before they figure you out.
Exactly.
Drew, does that help?
Yeah, that helps.
All right, good luck to you. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot. What's the most interesting thing you saw or learned going around as a kid to these operations? They're factories, I guess.
Factories. I mean, there's nothing as awe-inspiring as watching a blast furnace operate and, you know, pouring steel out of that. I love that textile processing equipment. I can watch it all day. I worked in an aluminum rolling mill. That was just incredible. Hmm. These just are huge, heavy machines. And the scale of industry, it really makes you appreciate the world that we live in when you see the heroic efforts we go to make the things that sound just every day.
What's the future of manufacturing in this country, do you think? There's been a push by the Obama administration to kind of bring it back. Apple made a big deal out of opening a plant, I think, in Tennessee or somewhere to manufacture iPhones, I think. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think the future of manufacturing everywhere, let's be perfectly honest, a lot of manufacturing jobs are pretty tedious and jobs that you wouldn't really want anyone to have. So, you know, that...
But not everybody can be an inventor.
Not everyone can be an inventor, but you may want them to not have to screw the cap onto every toothpaste tube.
But robots are doing most of that kind of stuff, aren't they?
So anyway, that's the future of manufacturing everywhere is robots, whether those robots be what they call CNC, so computer-controlled machine tools, or actual robots. And we are going to automate a lot of manufacturing, and I think that will bring a lot of manufacturing is already starting to back from Asia, and then the types of jobs in manufacturing change. I think all of this is a good thing and makes a more robust economy.
All right. Here's an email from Liz who writes, I'm a seventh grade math teacher, and I'm interested in letting my students do a semester-long project on figuring out how to make something mechanical or how something works. Do you have any ideas on what would be appropriate, challenging, and fun for 12-year-old students to investigate?
I think mathematics is so intricately tied up with all kinds of machines. It's fabulous. You know, you could have them just work on tilings, geometric tilings, which would be fun. You could have them work on making gearboxes and learning how gearboxes work. You know, I actually have a wonderful project I do with a comic book artist and his wife, Nick and Ingrid Dragotta, called Howtoons, and we create interesting projects for kids to become involved in. And you could have a look there. And in Make Magazine, there's a lot of resources. And I guess you look at these projects and then how do I tie them back to my curriculum? But with mathematics, I think there's so many handles, you know. Actually, I love this topic so much, I want to get your email and correspond with you.
We can get that for you. Let's see, another, I think this was probably a message on our Facebook page. What does your guest think about geoengineering, large-scale intervention in the climate system to control, or rather to counter global warming?
You know, this is because we failed. It's a bad idea because we failed at just addressing the problem. So I think we should at least understand it as an option. I am nervous of the double-edged sword. So if we understand that we can do geoengineering, does that make us lazier about actually dealing with the underlying cause, which is the producing carbon by the ways we produce energy? I would prefer we address this by changing our energy infrastructure.
Yeah. And so how would you go about that?
Well, we just got to make solar cheaper and wind cheaper and implement it at large scale, have a good conversation about nuclear. We haven't really developed any good new nuclear technologies. You know, I could give you a two-hour diatribe on how you solve that
and
problem.
And the politics are so tough.
Politics are super tough. And certainly in America right now, we have not even a reasonable debate. And the fact that we've just discovered, you know, low-cost natural gas domestically, it's a sort of a good thing because natural gas is lower carbon per unit of energy created, but it's also, it brings up the issues of fracking, and then, you know, because it's cheap, that's going to pervert the energy cost of energy in other places.
Yeah. Let's see if we can sneak another call in here. Margaret in Santa Rosa, welcome.
Oh, hi. I just want to thank you. I love your statement, Saul, that people's hands just want to make things. That is a standout statement to me. I teach art. I make art, and I teach it, and I can't teach it if I don't make it, obviously. But it's a way of apprehending the whole, I hesitate to use the word universe, but anyway, the way we exist in the world, we think with our hands. And I think that's such a big future of education. I will say that my mom was an old Australian, and she was demented in the last 10 years of her life, but she'd been a fine tailor and dressmaker, and her I think, didn't Oscar Wilde say the closest thing that humanity can come to nature is a perfectly made buttonhole? Anyway, our hands are our brains. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Bye.
To connect your question to one of the previous questions, you know, the math teacher who wants to know how to engage their students, you know, take textiles and garment making and tailoring. There's an enormous amount of mathematics in being able to plan out how textiles come together and how they fit, and you know, from folding an origami all the way through. And there's beautiful mathematics that in that, and a lot of these dressmakers and tailors were really quite fabulous engineers. And why not use that as the principle for a seventh grade math class? That would be fabulous.
Yeah, Margaret, thanks very much for the call. You know, all the things we've been talking about this hour are for the good of humanity. How concerned are you that you know, a brilliant inventor is going to be, you know, the next Dr. Evil, or maybe they're already out there?
Oh, this is an interesting question. I most people I know who are good at science or engineering, they're doing it because they want to create something that makes their own lives, you know, there's fairly selfish reasons. They want to make their own life better. And sometimes, you know, it sounds like it's for the good of humanity, but, you know, humanity as a byproduct gets these cool things that inventors and engineers and scientists make or understand for themselves. And I've met very few evil
geniuses.
Evil geniuses in my time. You know, people often ask me, are you worried about this, you know, this Google NSA scandals about
collecting data.
Collecting data and et cetera. And at the end of the day, having spent my whole life around all the nerds of the America's great universities, most of those nerds are on the side of good, and I think if the government oversteps its bounds, I trust my nerd brethren to defend us.
Although they may have to flee to Moscow.
Yeah, they'll win in the end.
Yeah. All right, Saul Griffith, thanks so much for being with us this hour. Good luck to you. What are you going to go back to the lab and do this afternoon?
Today, back to working on natural gas for transportation, solar energy, and robots.
All right, good. Well, thanks thanks for all your work and your ideas and sharing it with us this hour.
Thank you.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Vinny Tong. Our engineer today is Howard Gelman. Our engagement producer is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks and help from Chad McClymans. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer, here today for Michael Krasny. I will be back tomorrow, and we'll see you then.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.